superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
The election is finally over. What do the results mean for our region?
The Republicans' clear agenda in this election cycle was to create a veto-proof supermajority. It did not happen.
Plus, you may not get rich collecting a state legislator's salary, but it sure takes money to get elected.
This is a job that pays about $55,000 a year, and they have to each raise three times that.
We'll look at the price tag of our local political races. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The election is finally over, unless you happen to be visiting an area where they're still counting some race, but our local races are all wrapped up, and now it's time to figure out what they all mean. Here to help us dissect that is Alyssa Van Hagel, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Alyssa.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So we'll do this show by the numbers, and by that I mean district numbers for our region. The 73rd and 74th Assembly Districts, covering the Greater Superior and Ashland areas, respectively, and the 25th State Senate District, covering most of our Northwest Wisconsin listening area, Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District, and its neighbor, Minnesota's 8th District. And if we really want to get into it, we could talk about the gubernatorial and U.S. Senate races as well. But let's start with the 73rd Assembly District race between Democrat Laura Gapsky of Superior and Republican and winner Angie Sapik of Lake Nebagamon. Thoughts on that one?
So that race was, like many of these races in Wisconsin in general, was very close. Throughout the counting of the votes, and it changed kind of a little bit back and forth in terms of who was in the lead. And what I think stands out with this race, as well as the 74th Assembly race, is the amount of money specifically that the Republican campaign committees put into these races, because the Republicans' clear agenda in this particular election cycle was to create a veto-proof supermajority in the legislature. It did not happen, but they identified particular districts that they saw as that they could potentially flip. And the 73rd and the 74th were two of those districts. And so they put a lot of money and a lot of energy into, you know, campaigning for, providing resources for the Republican candidates. And it turns out that their work assisted in flipping both of those districts.
Mm-hmm. Although it did not get them the veto-proof majority.
Correct.
We're going to get into actually those precise numbers with Peter Cameron of the Badger Project a little bit later in the show. But these two districts, 73rd and 74th, the 74th in the Ashland area, between John Adams, the Democrat, and the winner, Chance Green, the Republican. Both were longtime Democratic districts. Nick Milroy is the outgoing Democratic representative for the 73rd, and Beth Myers has likewise held her seat for a while in the 74th. Both had tight races in the past.
Correct. We saw in recent years, especially in the previous election cycle, that candidates in these districts, these assembly districts, won by very small margins, very different from what we saw in the past. And so despite this, you know, sort of historical view of this being a more Democratic area, it has been changing. And it is clear the demographics were changing, political views were changing, and the races were certainly tightening in previous election cycles, which is, again, why the Republicans campaign committee specifically focused on these particular districts as districts that they could potentially win.
Mm-hmm. Go to the Senate side, the 25th Senate District, again, stretching from Bayfield through Superior and the greater area, most of our Wisconsin side of our listening area. This is the seat occupied by outgoing Senate Minority Leader, Democrat Janet Buley, who was not running again. Kelly Westland was hoping to be her Democratic replacement, who lost to Romaine Quinn, a former state representative and now the senator-elect.
Yes, and in this race we saw, I think, similar to the assembly races, where there was a lot of money thrown in by Republican campaign committee, much more than what was had on hand by the Democratic candidate. And so, again, I think a lot of that helped with respect to not only, advertising for the candidate, but also, you know, creating turnout or promoting turnout.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the advertising included ads by the candidates themselves, and as everyone in America should be used to by now, ads by parties and interested parties and others on behalf of candidates that candidates don't necessarily have to sign on to. Romaine Quinn had a whole bunch of really down-home folksy ads with his wife and his infant child. That kind of stuff make a difference?
It didn't talk about positions,
I should say.
Right, and it can in terms of just simply creating name recognition. A lot of races that are, you know, not national level offices, people are just tend to be less aware or knowledgeable about the candidates involved. And so simply creating or promoting name recognition is also, you know, a key way to drive people to the polls and to, you know, have that recognition while you're looking at the ballot in terms of voting. And that's why we see the plethora of lawn signs everywhere, you know, at least in the city of Superior. And again, that constant, you know, trigger name reminder is, you know, can help facilitate or can be facilitated by those positive messages. As you mentioned, the folksy kind of right. themed family down home messages certainly is meant to create a positive view of the candidate as well.
His were also, they were humorous and self-deprecating. His whole thing was making fun of his name, like Romaine Lettuce, and I'm going to be quoting his commercial or whatever, and I don't recall anything from Kelly Westland like that. I do recall, and these were the party ads or fellow traveler, third-party organizations, whatever ads that were negative against Romaine Quinn. And likewise, there were ads against Angie Sapik in the 73rd district that were very negative, but they didn't pay off in the end, I guess.
Correct. There was, as we got closer to the election, we saw that they, you know, and which is usually the case, we start to see, you know, arising, whether it's from, you know, independent organizations or from the party or the candidate themselves, attack ads. There's research, you know, on, you know, multiple findings or many different ways to look at sort of the effectiveness or impact they have. And you know, the jury, I think, is still out, but it certainly is shown to be more memorable for individuals, for people who are, again, perhaps do not have a lot of knowledge about the particular candidates or the race in general. And so, but again, as you mentioned, those ads were turned out to not be effective for Gapski, although when comparing her numbers to the 25th Senate District and the 74th Assembly District, she was much closer.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at some of the reasons behind the vote. Abortion, which Democrats thought would be a huge motivating factor, did not turn out to be so, or at least it didn't overpower inflation or whatever other reasons people went for the Republican candidates.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question because it, you know, certainly was the Democrats believed a key issue. And you saw lots of news interviews around the country of like anecdotes of individuals being interviewed and specifically identifying. I think inflation was the number one issue, but abortion was very high on the list in terms of key issues people are voting on this election cycle. And that is never the case. And also there were, I believe, three states that added constitutional amendments solidifying the right to access to abortion, California and Vermont, no surprise there, but also in Michigan.
One more thought on that, as you said that. You know what? That means Wisconsin is surrounded by states, I don't know about Iowa, but for the most part, that allow abortion.
Yes, correct. Yes, we are an outlier. And that, it is interesting how the candidates, specifically the Republican candidates, dealt with that issue, given that, you know, majority of Wisconsinites are in support of some or, you know, in all or certain circumstances, access to abortion.
Right.
And
right.
a majority of Wisconsinites were opposed to the Dobbs ruling. And so it was interesting seeing how some of the Republican candidates specifically attempted to either walk back from their more extreme statements or positions. And again, whether or not that had a dramatic impact on, you know, turnout or support, it's hard to say, of course, but I know that Evers specifically very much was very heavily focusing on that in his campaign.
The other thing I should point out, we're sitting here talking about ads. We never did that before because we didn't have TV ads for these tiny little races in our remote area, you know, looking at the beautiful lake. You know, I mean, whoever heard of TV ads here? So that speaks to what we were talking about, all the money going to the race and on both sides, obviously, because the ads ran on both sides. And I don't think the TV stations ran them for free. So we're speaking with Alyssa Van Hagel, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin Superior. We're doing a postmortem on the election, and we'll move to the congressional races, where there was no surprise that Republican Tom Tiffany was reelected in Wisconsin's 7th district.
He's an incumbent, and he has been following in the footsteps of another Republican who had been in that seat before. And so, again, the district, the way in particular the district has been drawn in the past few redistricting cycles purposefully created a more Republican-leaning district. And so it's, you know, in the future, it will be quite difficult for a prospective Democratic candidate to be successful, given just very simply the way the district is drawn.
And the Democratic challenger was Richard Osman. On the Minnesota side, we had the 8th congressional district race between Republican incumbent Pete Stauber and his Democratic challenger, State Representative Jen Schultz, and that went to Stauber also. By the way, both the 7th in Wisconsin and the 8th in Minnesota, again, were longtime Democratic strongholds until the last 10 years or so. But were you surprised by this one? It looked like Jen Schultz was a more viable candidate, I would say, than some we've had in the last few years.
Correct. I would agree. It is. She did have a strong showing, and certainly in terms of the vote in St. Louis County, she had a very strong showing there. And but certainly in those other counties that are at the edges of the district that tend to lean red, we're obviously going to go for Stauber. And again, given his incumbency status, incumbents are very, very difficult to beat. And this is a year, a midterm election cycle, where historically we know that the president's party is going to lose seats. And so for a Democrat to flip that district right now in this particular election cycle would have been extraordinarily difficult.
Mm-hmm. But it was in play at least a little bit more, again, than it had been in years. And
correct,
kind of important, very important, because the whole balance of power in the House of Representatives, you know, really is coming down to a number of seats you could count on one hand.
Correct, right. And so we still, I think, do not know about the Senate, and we probably won't know for a while. But certainly the Republicans were attempting to take back the House, and I believe it seems that is probably going to be the case. And so certainly they would, you know, in terms of the national level organization and deciding races to, contribute funds to those races that are competitive and those seats that they need to hold on to, will certainly drive a lot of their decisions in terms of contributing campaign funds, spending resources, having national known figures come to help campaign in those particular districts. And so I think the Minnesota 8th is that particular example of a district where the National Republican Campaign Committee would identify as a seat they need to hold on to.
Mm-hmm. But I didn't see, as you just said, a lot of national support coming out for Jen Schultz. I'm sure there was some, but we certainly didn't have any high-ranking Democratic officials. Well, I didn't see them. If I missed them, I'm sorry, and that's not a personal slight toward any of them.
I don't believe so. Nothing is on my radar with respect to national level Democratic political figures in Minnesota 8 specifically.
And obviously, Tom Tiffany didn't need much help in Wisconsin 7th. In the Wisconsin governor's race, Tony Evers turned back Republican challenger Tim Michaels, and Tim Waltz, the Star Tribune said he waltzed to victory in Minnesota as a re-election as governor. Any surprises there on Tony Evers?
I think it is interesting that with respect to the Wisconsin gubernatorial race and the Wisconsin Senate race, that both incumbents won. They were incumbents from different political parties. So we have Ron Johnson maintaining his Senate seat for the state of Wisconsin.
In his race against Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes.
Correct. And so, again, both of those races leading up into the election were neck and neck. I don't know that there was any polling organization in the country that was willing to predict one way or the other who had the upper hand or not. And so those races were very, very close. And yet we saw both incumbents hang on to the seat. And so if that indicates something about the challengers who were running in both of those instances, or simply people wanting to keep incumbents in office or whatnot, it is hard to guess exactly what the, you know, what is behind that.
Right. CNN was making a big deal, its commentators, about races such as Wisconsin, also in Georgia and Pennsylvania, in which the gubernatorial winner, or apparent winner in some of these cases, was of one party, but the Senate winner was of another. So that implied that voters actually, are you ready for this, split their ticket.
Correct. Yes, I've been reading about that as well. And it's a phenomenon that we haven't seen as much of as of late, given the extraordinary hyperpartisanship and polarization. And so, you know, whatever is behind that seeming increase is, it could be based on the candidates themselves in those instances or in those particular cases, or it could be a larger, you know, political phenomenon that's going on. But it is something that, you know, again, voters have done.
And again, happening in several different states. So it's
correct.
Not an anomaly limited to Wisconsin. Lastly on this, and I'm not trying to give you a pop quiz or anything like this, but I realized something. My question was going to be, does Mandela Barnes keep his lieutenant governor job? But then I looked it up and found the answer to that.
Okay. And so he does not, correct?
He does not, right, yes.
Right.
And it's funny because it tells you, even people like you or me who look and pay attention to these things, we didn't quite realize, wait a minute, Evers has to have a lieutenant governor running mate, and it wasn't Barnes. Although you can run for two offices at the same time, as Joel Lieberman proved way back in 2000 when he ran for his Senate seat and won re-election, as he ran for vice president and lost that election. So our new lieutenant governor in Wisconsin, drumroll please, for people who have not seen her name, is Sarah Rodriguez.
Correct.
We'll have to work on her name recognition. So if you hadn't heard it, you heard it here first.
With the governor's race, it was the most expensive governor's race in the country.
Hmm.
It was the most expensive race in Wisconsin's history. But also just nationwide, the most expensive gubernatorial race. And so I believe the total was $115 million, which does not include the, you know, so-called dark money or money spent by organizations on, you know, attack ads that are not affiliated with the candidate themselves.
That is a lot of money, but then again, a lot of stuff was at stake here.
That's true. That is true.
Right. Coming up, so how much does it cost to run for the Assembly or State Senate from our region? We'll look at the numbers. Plus, a Superior resident turns 105. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So now that we have an idea of the significance of the election results, let's take a look at the price tag.
Money.
A group that keeps track of campaign donations is the Badger Project, a nonpartisan and nonprofit watchdog based in Madison. Peter Cameron is managing editor of the Badger Project, and he joins me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
So we spoke at the beginning of the campaign. There was a beginning. I think it was back in February. And back then you were predicting that donations for some of our local races for what used to be small little assembly and Senate districts could reach $1 million. How much were we seeing before all that, and how did it turn out this time?
Yeah, so last time I said that I'm not going to make predictions because they're always wrong.
Right.
And guess what? My prediction was wrong again. So your state Senate race up there for Janet Buley's old seat, it's an expensive race by historical standards, but it's not getting up into the $1 million unless there was some crazy amount of donations happening in the last couple weeks here. Mm-hmm. It's we've got Romaine Quinn had raised about $380,000, $400,000 to Westland's about $250,000. Hmm. So you're getting into what? You're getting into $600,000, $700,000 there. That's only to about the beginning of November. So we had some few days where some significant money could be dropped from mm-hmm. political parties. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I'm actually a little surprised considering how important this seat is.
Right. The Democratic candidate was Kelly Westland, and the Republican was Romaine Quinn. Still, $250,000 by Westland and $380,000 by Quinn is a lot more than ever was spent before, though, correct?
The last time Janet Buley defended her seat, that would have been, what, 2018? They were up in that range. They had both raised about $300-something thousand. So you're talking about $600,000, $700,000. In direct donations in that race. So I think it's going to be it's close to or at least already a little bit over. That's as of about early November. One thing I wanted to just remind everyone of, I think people don't know this, is that in Wisconsin, if you want to make a donation to a political candidate for governor all the way down to state assembly, state senator, there's a limit on what you can give them per election cycle. However, there no longer is a limit on what anyone can donate to a political party in Wisconsin, and there also is no limit on what that political party can donate to a candidate. So you're seeing tons and tons of money being funneled through political parties to political candidates. And so both of these candidates have had tens of thousands of dollars come from their political parties. Mm-hmm. That is a loophole in campaign finance law. Democrats have wanted to close that loophole and put limits on what you can donate to a political party and what a political party can donate to a candidate. Republicans have not wanted to do that. They have control of the legislature. But ironically, the Wisconsin Democratic Party is outraising the Republican Party of Wisconsin now. So that loophole that Republicans refuse to close is actually helping Democrats now. So
mm-hmm. Let's continue with the roundup here of the 74th District, again in the Bayfield area, which saw John Adams on the Democratic side and Chance Green on the Republican side, heated contest. What did they spend?
I'm looking at the numbers here. They've both raised about $150,000 and presumably spent that as well. So that, I mean, that's pretty expensive by historical standards. For again, this is a job that pays about $55,000 a year, and they have to each raise three times that, and that's probably about end of October, early November.
Mm-hmm. That's a 2-year term, so if you're thinking you're getting your money back, you're not going to. Yeah.
Right, they'll have to do it again in 2 years. The Republican is slightly outraising the Democrat. A lot of that money again is coming from political parties because you can only donate $1,000. Per election cycle to a candidate for state assembly.
And I'm going to say the big one, but they're all big ones. And because as you pointed out, any one of these seats can make a huge difference. But one that has been reliably Democratic and getting a razor thin margin in the previous election by the retiring Democrat, Nick Milroy, is the 73rd district of Greater Superior. Angie Sapik on the Republican side and Laura Gapsky on the Democratic side. How did they fare?
So again, as of about end of October, the Republican had raised almost $300,000 and the Democrat had raised about $240,000. So fairly similar. And that, you know, again, that doesn't include whatever came in late from late donors or the political parties themselves, which can infuse the campaigns with cash in the last week or so.
Mm-hmm. That's actually close to the 25th Senate district, more so than the comparable assembly district.
That's true, but that's definitely a more expensive seat. I mean, I don't follow up that closely, but SAPIC has been in the news quite a bit, I know, making some statewide news, so that might be attracting attention from both sides in terms of campaign donations.
Well, we're going to talk about some of that news, or at least media, in terms of commercials and Facebook posts and all kinds of stuff. But first, we're speaking with Peter Cameron. He's managing editor of the Badger Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit watchdog group based in Madison. So what did they spend them on? Do you have any idea? And I'll tell you what I've seen, turning on my TV and turning on my computer. You know, I cannot ever remember seeing a TV ad for the 74th District covering Bayfield. So that's new ground, at least on my airwaves. I certainly have seen the 73rd District this time. And boy, the Senate commercials have been like crazy. And then, as I said, my Facebook feed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the Madison area today. But generally speaking, I can tell you that, yeah, they're spending that money on political messaging, which mostly is TV ads, radio ads. I mean, now, yeah, online ads, YouTube, Facebook, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then mailers.
It appears to me that a good number of the ads are not by the candidates themselves.
Yeah, I mean, if you see somebody, if you say, I'm Donald Trump, I'm Joe Biden, I approve of this message, you know, then that's generally mm-hmm. the campaign doing the spending. Mm-hmm. But if it's an outside group that's not coordinating with the campaign, then they, you know, it'll say, I don't know, Americans for Prosperity. That's the Koch Brothers Network. So they might be attacking a candidate or promoting a candidate. But it's usually fairly clear whether it's in coordination with the candidate.
Right. They seem more to be the attacked ads. Is there any accounting of what they spend them on? I mean, there must be something.
Yes. I mean, everything the candidate spends has to be reported. So that's all reportable. That's all disclosed. Mm-hmm. The issue is you get into some of these dark money groups, the independent groups. It can be unclear where some of that money is coming from. So, and that's what people know the word Citizens United. Citizens United was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that allowed the creation of these super PACs, which could raise unlimited amount of funds and spend unlimited amount of funds.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that the Supreme Court said is that the answer to all this money coming in is more disclosure. Democrats have in the Senate have tried to pass a disclosure law that would force that disclosure. Republicans have refused that. Interesting now, because Democrats are doing quite well in dark money fundraising. Whether that will change the politics of it on a national level, you know, we'll see. But that's so some of that of the spending in your districts up there is it's hard to track where exactly it's coming from.
I want to go back to the 73rd district. And again, Angie Sapik, you said about $300,000 on the Republican side. Laura Gapsby, about $240,000 on the Democratic side as of October. What were the previous amounts?
I haven't done any reporting on the, I don't know what, I just did state Senate.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because the assembly stuff last time was not, it just wasn't on my radar. So I just focused on it. Now it is, though.
How things change.
Yeah, now it is, yeah.
Well, you segue to my next question, which is I know you don't like predictions, but predictions for the future. These are all certainly on your radar today. Do we see them going up? It certainly is not going to go down, is it?
I doubt it. Not when you have rare swing districts up there in northwestern Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as there aren't many swing districts, and so both parties are going to fight tooth and nail over them. The districts could change in time for the next election. That could scramble everything.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a state Supreme Court justice election coming up. If the liberals win that could totally swing everything. I mean, it's possible that a liberal majority on the state Supreme Court could do what Supreme Courts have done in the past in Wisconsin and bring in somebody to draw new districts, nonpartisan mm-hmm. districts, and that would just change everything in the state. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen, but if the status quo continues, your districts will continue to be fought over tooth and nail by the state political parties.
Mm-hmm. Well, one that is now Republican lock and used to be Democratic on the broader scale is the 7th Congressional District. And that saw incumbent Tom Tiffany pretty much presumed to have it all locked up against Democrat Richard Osman. But how much money was spent anyway?
I can look that up. I don't have that at my, let me get that. Well,
spent some money.
So I don't have the spending, but I have what they raised, which is not always the same number, probably not in this race. But Tom Tiffany, according, I'm looking at the Open Secrets database. You can, it's opensecrets.org, takes financial campaign finance reporting data that goes to the Federal Elections Commission. And so you can check who's donating to your candidates. But Tom Tiffany has raised over $1 million, according to this. And Ausman only about 76,000. So you're talking pennies to dollars there.
Oh, well, we may have seen that one reflected at the polling place. Well, we've been speaking with Peter Cameron. He's managing editor of the Badger Project, a nonpartisan and nonprofit watchdog group. We've been talking about campaign donations and spending in our now highly contested districts in Northwest Wisconsin. Thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we've got a few more races to cover and remembering a local music legend. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And I bet you're going to have a few more election items for your news roundup.
Definitely. Quite a few. We'll start with Gordon Ramsey being elected St. Louis County Sheriff. He left his hometown nearly 7 years ago to pursue a new career challenge in an unfamiliar state. But on Tuesday, the former Duluth police chief received a warm welcome home from St. Louis County voters, who elected him as their first new sheriff in two decades. Ramsey defeated Undersheriff Jason Lukowski by a margin of nearly 50% to 40%, according to unofficial results Wednesday from the Minnesota Secretary of State. Another 10% went to write-in candidates, presumably for part-time Moose Lake police officer and local gun shop owner Chad Walsh, who maintained an active campaign after losing the August primary. Ramsey will succeed Ross Littman, who was first elected in 2002 and never faced a challenger in any of his four re-election bids. Ramsey said that it is heartwarming and very appreciative that the people have believed in me and given me their vote. 38,000 miles I've put on my truck campaigning in St. Louis County, and it has been very rewarding. Now, while he faced an internal candidate who enjoyed the support of the outgoing sheriff and the deputies union, Ramsey said he has no qualms about stepping into leadership of an agency in which he has never served. Lukowski and Ramsey, both 50 years old and Duluth natives, each campaigned on their extensive law enforcement experience in the Northland as they sought the approval of voters as the best candidate to address issues including community relations, staffing shortages, drug and mental health response, and collaborative crime fighting across the county that includes more than a dozen independent police departments. Ramsey, an East High School graduate, worked his way up the ranks of the hometown police department and spent nearly a decade as a highly visible police chief. He implemented one of the nation's first body camera initiatives, paired social workers with officers, oversaw the move to a new headquarters, and helped create the Citizen Review Board. But then he left in 2016 to take the reins of the Wichita Police Department, overseeing an agency roughly four times the size of Duluth. He touted his efforts to diversify the force and reduce rates of robberies and burglaries to levels not seen in several decades before stepping down earlier this year to return to Duluth to be closer to family. The St. Louis County Sheriff's Office has a $36 million budget for 2022, includes roughly 280 employees who work in administration, patrol investigations, civil warrants, and court security divisions.
All right. Well, Duluth had a measure for all of its citizens to decide concerning its parklands.
Yes, and city leaders are considering new strategies to fund local trails and recreational amenities after that measure failed on election night. Voters narrowly rejected a plan to boost local property taxes. The measure fell 203 votes short of passage, or a margin of just 0.56%. Duluth already has a dedicated property tax that raises $2.6 million annually to support city parks and trails, but Mayor Emily Larson announced in August her hope to change that fixed revenue stream into one that grows with increasing value of a local property base, putting the proposal to a public referendum vote in November. At-large City Councilor Noah Hobbs said supporters of the idea were hard-pressed to make the case for a tax change so swiftly. Hobbs said he believes the referendum could well have passed with the benefit of a few more weeks of additional time to educate voters, especially in light of the complicated nature of the question put to the public on Tuesday. Larson said the cumbersome nature of the language on the ballot made the level of support the referendum received that much more remarkable. Despite the referendum's recent defeat, Larson said it could be reintroduced in some form in the future. She pointed to an example of a referendum to allow sales of liquor in Duluth's Lakeside neighborhood that passed only with the benefit of repeat votes.
All right. And one of the areas, and actually Minnesota's longest serving legislators, had an uncertain electoral result Tuesday night.
Yes, just 35 votes helped Natalie Zlesnikar, a Republican from Duluth, edge Representative Mary Murphy, the longest serving female legislator in Minnesota, in the House District 3B race, according to unofficial results Wednesday morning. Murphy of Hermantown has held the seat for the DFL since 1976. Zlesnikar received 10,812 votes, while Murphy had 10,777, according to the Minnesota Secretary of State's office, which says that the race falls within the parameters of a publicly funded recount. District 3B includes Two Harbors and other unorganized territories in Lake County. Also includes Proctor, Rice Lake, Hermantown, and several townships in St. Louis County.
Well, we'll see if it indeed gets to a recount and what the result will be. Finally, the Twin Ports music scene lost one of their own before her time, I would say. Mimi Parker of the band Lowell died last week.
Yes, the music world is certainly mourning the loss of Parker. She died Saturday at the age of 55 due to ovarian cancer. On Sunday night at Sacred Heart Music Center, about 200 people attended a candlelight vigil for Parker while the music of Lowell played in the background. Parker's husband and bandmate, Alan Sparhawk, wrote on Twitter, "You really lifted us up tonight, Duluth. Your love is perfect and overwhelming. Spread it. Thank you." As friends, peers, and fans reflected on Parker's life and legacy, tributes poured in. And in a remarkable sign of how Parker's impact has been felt, Robert Plant paid tribute by covering two Lowell songs Sunday night in Scotland. At a concert in Glasgow, Plant and his band Saving Grace performed Monkey and Everybody's Song. Of course, Plant is best known as the frontman for Led Zeppelin. He said on stage that we've been drawn to the music of the great duo Lowell from Duluth, Minnesota. Noting Parker's death, Plant continued, "They've been such an inspiration to me for a long time." Parker contributed drums, vocals, and songwriting to Lowell, which he co-founded in Duluth in 1993 with bandmates Sparhawk and John Nichols. Now, while the bassist role has changed over the band's three-decade history, spouses Parker and Sparhawk remained the core of the internationally known group. They raised two children in Duluth, even as they recorded extensively and toured internationally. The band's final performance was in Duluth on September 4 at Bayfront Festival Park during the Water is Life Festival.
And she will indeed be missed. We've been joined by Rick Lovers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And before you go, Rick, what happened in Superior 105 years ago this week?
I'm going to guess the Spanish flu epidemic.
That actually was around at that time, but outlasting that and most anyone else who was around back then is Isabel Tucson, who was born in Superior 105 years ago on Wednesday and still lives in the city after some travels during the World War II years. We caught up with her for her 102nd birthday in 2019. Here's a snippet from our visit with her then. Tell me about growing up in Superior.
It was a nice, safe place to grow up in. And at that time, we had quite a few Jewish families here. so that we didn't have to go to Duluth, you know, for all our friends. We had three synagogues here at one time. We had a lot of stores on Tower Avenue, and you could hardly walk Tower Avenue on Thursday nights. It was so crowded. And there used to be a popcorn stand and candy store that was open, and it was delicious, just the smells to go by it. And Thursday night, that's when everybody came out. You couldn't find a parking spot on Tower Avenue. And the stores were open till 9.
Any particular?
A lot of restaurants. Every block had a restaurant. So you could stop at every block and you could get a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, anything you wanted. And we had a lot of dress shops. We had we had a lot of men's stores. I mean, men's stores, not in department stores, but single stores.
It's a little bit different than it is now.
Very different.
Was this during Prohibition?
Oh, yeah.
Didn't you guys deliver for the moonshiners?
Not me.
No, who did?
No, that was my cousin and her dad. The kids walked down the streets like they were carrying pop. Everybody knew they were doing that down there. But it was very wide open, I guess. My dad never did anything like that. He had a grocery store on Main Street. Mm-hmm. And he looked down on that. Boy, he thought it was terrible.
You know, I always wondered, what did you do on Passover?
We used to have all our Passover dinners at my Zadie and Bubby's. And then all of us would sit around the big table. And my aunts were in the high school at that time, and I was eighth grade. And we'd put Love Story magazines in our lap and look down like we were being very pious.
But what I meant was the Passover service, you're supposed to have wine. So what did you do during the Prohibition? Did you have wine?
We all had wine. They made their own. My mother always made her own wine. And I didn't know anybody who didn't.
So going to high school.
In high school, what was interesting, Jewish kids could not join no sororities or fraternities. They never allowed us in there.
For college or for high school?
High school.
So there were sororities and fraternity.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but not for you.
I could join the clubs like the swimming clubs or the school clubs, but I couldn't go into the school sororities or anything because Jewish kids weren't allowed. And that was in public school.
Right. So, but is that where you knew Richard Bong?
Richard Bong was in a study hall with me, but I never was in a class with him. And he was very, very quiet. So quiet you wouldn't know he was there. And we talked because I always talked. But you wouldn't know he could have been on the farm yet because he never talked in school. He was real quiet. Yeah, nice guy though.
And John Blatnick? Now that was a bit later, or?
Oh, Blatnick was my father-in-law, is the one that talked him to go into politics. And my father-in-law is the one that helped him win the range, which I think is interesting because he was a school teacher. And my father-in-law said he would make a good legislator. And then he offered my husband a job in Washington when he became one. But my father-in-law wouldn't allow my husband to take any kind of government job or any jobs like that. He always said, you can help people out, but that doesn't mean they have to pay you for it.
After high school, you went to college where?
I went to Marquette University in Milwaukee. And then when I got through, my dad said my education wasn't complete, so then I went to business school.
But first you went, it was dental hygiene, correct?
First I went for dental hygiene. And like I said, after when I graduated, my dad said my education wasn't complete, so I went to business school and graduated from that, too.
But the other problem, as I understand, was there weren't a whole bunch of people clamoring to hire you as a dental hygienist.
Dental hygienist? You know, most of your dentists were afraid at that time to hire a dental hygienist. They were afraid you're going to take their business away from them. Rather than adding to their business, they were afraid you were going to take it away from them. It was terrible. It really was. I couldn't get a job in Duluth or Superior, but I got a job in Ashland from a far-seeing dentist who was ahead of his time.
So what were some of the high points after you came back to Superior?
There wasn't many high points.
I know people ask you this all the time, I'm sure. To what do you attribute your health and your well-being?
Keeping busy. To me, I think that's the biggest secret of everything is keeping busy and get kind of nosy, know what's going on in the world. And as long as you keep your mind going, you're all right. I think that's the whole secret of staying busy.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was fun that I just talking to you.
And those were memories by Isabel Tucson of Superior, shared with us on her 102nd birthday 3 years ago. Time flies. This year, she received all sorts of well wishes, greetings, and cards for her 105th birthday that she celebrated on Wednesday right here in her hometown of Superior. Happy birthday, Isabel. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with the music of Low and the voice of Mimi Parker. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Shame.